All right, diving in. Today, it's Ezra and Nehemiah, kind of hidden gems in the Bible, wouldn't you say? We've got Dr. Tiberius Rada as our guide, and wow, his lecture is eye-opening. Exile, return, rebuilding, like a biblical extreme home makeover, but with a lot more, well, everything.
Oh, absolutely. It's amazing how these books, often tucked away, speak so directly to us today. Leadership, faith, the power of God's promises. It's all there.
So before we get to the nitty-gritty of Ezra and Nehemiah, let's paint the backdrop. What's the historical setup here?
Okay, so we need to rewind to the monarchy in Israel. It was a shift, right, from theocracy, God ruling directly, to having kings. Mm. Saul, David, Solomon, big names. Each one, well, they shaped the nation's path. Mm. David, for instance, he expands the kingdom, makes Jerusalem the capital. And Solomon, he's Mr. Construction, famous for, well, the temple.
Yeah, yes, the temple. More than just a building, right?
Oh, way more. It was the symbol of God's presence with his people. Picture it. The altar, the holy place, even the Ark of the Covenant right there in the Holy of Holies was powerful stuff. But eventually, this incredible temple is destroyed. And that leads to a turning point. Exile.
Okay, so Grand Temple to exile. What happened in between?
So after Solomon, things split. Israel in the north, Judah in the south. The north, bigger, but it crumbles first. Lots of upheaval, dynasties changing all the time. The south, Judah, they're more stable. One dynasty, David's line, the line that would eventually produce the Messiah. But here's the thing. Both kingdoms, they're wrestling with sin. And the prophets, they're shouting warnings from the rooftops.
So it wasn't just politics. There's a spiritual side to this downfall.
Exactly. The prophets, their message is all about sin, judgment, but also this promise of restoration. Idolatry, injustice, empty rituals, going through the motions without real change. That's what they're reeling against.
Trying to hide the bad stuff behind a facade of being good, right?
Precisely. But nobody's listening. And both kingdoms, they face the music. The north falls to Assyria in 722 BC, the south to Babylon, 587 BC. Temple's destroyed, Jerusalem's walls are rubble, and lots of people are exiled.
Feels like, well, the end of the world for them, no?
Oh, absolutely. Loss, disorientation, the whole nine yards. But, and this is often missed, not everyone gets exiled. And not everyone comes back either. Even in judgment, God's plan is moving forward.
And then a sliver of hope. Enter Cyrus.
Ah, yes. Cyrus the Great, a pagan king, Persian, conquers Babylon. And then, get this, 539 BC, he makes this incredible declaration. He lets the exiled Jews go back home. And not just that, he gives them money to rebuild the temple.
Whoa, hold up. A pagan king financing the temple of the God of Israel? That's wild. That's just coincidence.
That's what Dr. Rada wants us to wrestle with. See, centuries earlier, the prophet Jeremiah, he predicted a 70-year exile. Now, do the math. Jerusalem falls in 587 BC. Take away 70 years, you land in 517 BC. And guess what? That's the exact year the temple gets rebuilt. Cyrus gives the okay in 539, but full restoration. Dr. Rada says that meant a functioning temple, sacrifices happening again.
So it's like God's working behind the curtain, even using a pagan king, a master plan playing out, even when things look messy.
Precisely. And get this, Isaiah calls Cyrus the Lord's anointed, or get this, Messiah.
Wait, Messiah? Isn't that, well, usually about Jesus?
That's how we think of it now, sure. But back then, Messiah meant anyone appointed by God for a specific job. Cyrus, pagan king, he's a tool in God's plan. Makes you think about who God uses, right? How his purpose gets done.
Really makes you think. So green light from Cyrus and the exiles head back to Jerusalem. Just one big wave of people.
Actually, three distinct waves, all chronicled in Ezra and Nehemiah. First wave, Zerubbabel, Joshua, and Sheshbazzar. They're the leaders. About 50,000 people, can you imagine? That's a lot of luggage.
That's some serious moving day. Okay, so they return, start rebuilding, smooth sailing from there.
Not quite. We'll get to the bumps in the road next time. But first, let's zoom in on something in Ezra chapter 2. Might seem like a snooze fest at first. It's a list, a long list of names.
Lists, not exactly the most exciting part of the Bible, I'll admit. What makes this one different?
Easy to skim over it, right?
Yeah.
But this list, it's real people, their families, carefully written down. It's all about belonging, identity, in this new community. Not just genealogy, it's God saying, I brought my people back together.
More than just names on paper, these are individual stories, huh? Stories of faith, of coming back from hardship.
Exactly. And there's more to uncover. We'll get to that and all the challenges they faced next time.
We're back, diving deeper into Ezra and Nehemiah. Before we took a break, we were looking at that long list of names in Ezra. Easy to get lost in the details, but what's the takeaway, the big picture?
It's more than just names, It's the Israelites rebuilding a nation, a history, an identity. After exile, everything's shattered. Each name, it's a thread, weaving them back together.
So not just names, but hope, a community coming back to life. But I remember Dr. Rada talked about purity, too. What did he mean by that?
Well, think about it. They'd been living among all sorts of, well, pagan cultures during exile. So there's this worry, right, about keeping their identity, their distinctiveness, their faithfulness to God's law. Kind of like setting boundaries, physical and spiritual.
Rebuilding the temple, the wall, sure, but also their way of life, their relationship with God.
Exactly. And this purity thing, it shows up in a few ways, like the whole issue of intermarriage, marrying people from the surrounding nations. That was a big deal.
Wait, intermarriage was a problem. Why?
You got to remember the historical context, right? The Israelites, they had a track record. Mixing with other cultures, they often ended up, well, worshiping idols. Like, remember that golden calf incident back in Exodus?
Oh, yeah. Not their finest moment.
Exactly. So that kind of solidified the idea, right? Staying true to God meant staying separate from those who didn't follow him. It wasn't about, like, ethnic prejudice or anything. It was about protecting their faith, their covenant with God.
Purity, staying true to God's commands, even when surrounded by different cultures, that becomes a recurring theme then.
Absolutely. It's woven throughout Ezra and Nehemiah. And you know what? It connects with us too. We'll see how it all plays out.
Okay, before we go further, quick recap of those three waves of return. Make sure we're all on the same page.
Good idea.
Yeah.
So we've got wave one, Zerubbabel and crew. They lay the groundwork, rebuild the temple. Wave two, Ezra shows up, all about spiritual revival, the law of Moses, that purity we talked about. And wave three, it's Nehemiah. He leads the rebuilding of Jerusalem's walls, adds that physical security, restoration, you know, on multiple levels.
Got it. Now, each of these leaders, they had their own set of hurdles, right? What were the biggest obstacles they faced?
One biggie. Opposition from the neighbors. They felt threatened. You know, the Israelites coming back, rebuilding it, shook things up. So they use all sorts of tactics, trying to block the whole project.
Yeah.
Political stuff, threats, even violence.
So even though they're trying to rebuild their lives, reconnect with God, they've got serious pushback.
Oh, yeah. It put their faith to the test, their leadership, their commitment to rebuilding.
Okay, let's dig into this opposition. Who are these folks trying to stop them?
Dr. Rada points out a few key players. First, the Samaritans. They'd popped up in the north way back after the Assyrian conquest. They claimed to worship the God of Israel, but their practices, the returnees from Judah, they weren't buying it.
Right, their own version of the faith, like different interpretations. So how did that play out?
Friction, basically. Mm-hmm. Two groups, both saying we're the real deal. The Samaritans, they saw the Jerusalem temple as a threat. Competition, you know, so try to undermine the whole thing.
More than just a theological debate, sounds like power struggle, maybe even a bit of jealousy.
You got it. Adds another layer to the story, right?
Yeah.
Rebuilding a nation, trying to find unity, but there's deep division, competing claims to, well, spiritual authority.
Okay, so the Samaritans are stirring the pot. Who else was in this anti-return club?
The Samaritans, yeah, but other groups too. They resented the Israelites coming back, the support they got from Persia. Oh. They saw it as a threat politically, economically. Change always makes some people nervous.
It's like a chain reaction. Jerusalem being rebuilt, it wasn't just about the city. It shifted things for the whole region.
You said it. Power dynamics, economics, everything got reshuffled. And those who benefited from the old way, they weren't happy. Geopolitics, it's a high-stakes game.
High stakes, indeed. Okay, Samaritans and others are trying to sabotage things. How did they actually go about it? What were their tactics?
Mix of brute force and cunning. Some, they went for straight-up attacks. Construction workers harassed, the work disrupted. Others, they got political, whispering in the ears of Persian officials, trying to turn them against the Israelites.
Farce and sneaky tactics. Two-pronged attack.
Exactly. And it worked, at least for a while. Delays, setbacks, you name it.
Makes you wonder, how did they keep going? With all that resistance, where did they find the strength?
Their faith, their belief that God had brought them back to Jerusalem, that he would see them through. They prayed, they dug into the law, they leaned on his strength.
Faith in action, right. Not just believing, but living it out, even when things get rough.
Absolutely. They show us what it means to have a faith that doesn't quit, that can weather any storm. And that's a challenge for us, too.
Inspiring, but I gotta be honest, I'm also feeling a bit overwhelmed. All these details, the names, the dates, the groups. Is it okay to feel a bit lost sometimes?
Totally normal. This is a deep dive, right? We're getting into the nitty-gritty, taking our time. And sometimes those little details, they lead to the biggest aha moments.
It's like those tiny brush strokes in a painting. They all come together to make something amazing.
Exactly. Every detail, every name, date, group, challenge, it all adds to the story. It helps us understand not just what happened, but why it matters, how it fits into God's big plan.
Okay, I'm ready to keep going. What happens next in the saga? Do the Israelites catch a break?
They do. In the midst of all the opposition, there's this moment, a pivotal moment. The foundation of the temple, it's finally laid.
After all that, seeing that foundation, it must have been incredibly emotional. Hope taking shape right before their eyes.
Powerful, for sure. But Dr. Rada points out, it was bittersweet. Some people, they rejoiced, praised God. The others, they wept. Remembering Solomon's temple, all that was lost.
Like a bittersweet symphony. Joy mixed with a tinge of sadness. Remembering the past, but also looking towards the future.
Beautiful way to put it. It shows how complex rebuilding is.
Yeah.
It's not a straight line. Ups and downs, triumphs, setbacks, all these emotions swirling around, dealing with what was, navigating the now, and facing the unknown future.
It's a good reminder that healing, whether it's personal or for a whole nation, it's messy, right? Not always a smooth process. So temple foundation is down. But I'm guessing the work wasn't done yet.
You're right. They kept building. And guess what? Another wave of opposition hits, even stronger this time.
Oh, no, not another one. What happened this time?
Well, those who'd been trying to stop them, they realized, we got to step up our game. They joined forces, a coalition, much more formidable. It's almost like a supervillain team up, pooling their resources, their strategies to stop the heroes of our story.
Love that analogy. Okay, tell me more about this supervillain team. Who are the big names?
We've got the Samaritans, of course. But this time, they teamed up with others. The Ammonites, the Moabites, the Edomites.
Wait a sec, those names ring a bell. Weren't those like ancient enemies of the Israelites way back in the Old Testament?
Sharp memory. Their beef with the Israelites, it went way back. Centuries of territorial stuff, political rivalries, even personal grudges.
Wow, so it wasn't just about this situation. It was a whole history of bad blood resurfacing.
Exactly. Makes the opposition even more complex, right? It's not just current events. It's old wounds, old scores to settle.
This is getting intense. A real-life historical drama.
Mm-hmm.
So how did this supervillain team try to stop things this time?
They figured out brute force wasn't enough. They needed something subtler, sneakier, something to undermine the Israelites' support from Persia, to make them look bad, untrustworthy.
So from a frontal attack to psychological warfare, trying to poison the well, so to speak.
Precisely. One of their best tricks. Rumors, false accusations, painting the Israelites as rebels, trying to turn the Persians against them, using fear and suspicion. Classic move.
Cunning. But also so frustrating. They're just trying to rebuild their lives. It's like even today, right? Misinformation,
right.
Propaganda, it can distort the truth, wreck good intentions.
You got it. Timeless tactic, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And in a big empire like Persia, with all its bureaucracy, well, it was ripe for manipulation.
Ugh. Makes you wonder if truth ever stands a chance against well-crafted lies. Did the Israelites have any way to fight back?
That's the million-dollar question. And we'll dive into their response and a totally unexpected twist when we come back for the final part of our deep dive into Ezra and Nehemiah.
All right, back to Ezra and Nehemiah. Last time, things weren't looking so good. Enemies spreading lies, messing with the Persians, trying to wreck the whole rebuilding project. So how did the Israelites handle that? Did they just, like, give in?
At first, they tried to fight back, you know, set the record straight, call out the lies. But they quickly realized it was pointless. These folks were determined to sabotage them. Reasoning wasn't going to work.
So what then? Throw in the towel.
Nope. They did something smarter. Instead of arguing, they took it higher, you know, to God. Prayer. Intense prayer. Asking for his help. They studied the law, looked for his guidance, leaned on his strength to keep going. Sometimes the biggest battles are fought on our knees, right?
Makes you think about spiritual warfare in a new light. It's not always like swords and shields. Sometimes it's about trusting God's got your back, even when you can't see it.
Exactly. And that trust. It was crucial for the Israelites. They were up against a powerful group. They knew they couldn't win this on their own.
So they're praying, seeking God, but the opposition's still whispering in the Persian king's ear. Did anything change?
It did. And it came from a surprising place. A new king came to power in Persia, Darius the First.
Ah, regime change. Sometimes that's all it takes. New leadership, fresh perspective. What was Darius like?
Turns out, he was a much fairer, smarter ruler than the guys before him. Rumors, political games, that didn't sway him. He wanted facts. So he orders an investigation, gets to the bottom of those accusations against the Israelites. Truth time.
Love it. It's like the fog clears, truth shines through. What happened with the investigation?
It exposed the whole scheme. All the lies, the manipulation, it all came out. Darius, he saw the truth plain as day. So he issues a new decree, backs the Israelites, their right to rebuild, and gives them the protection of the Persian Empire. Mic drop.
Boom. That's a win. Proof that even when it feels hopeless, truth can win out. So temples rebuilt, bad guys defeated, the Israelites can finally relax, happy ending, right?
Not so fast. Remember that purity theme we talked about? Well, it comes back with a vengeance as we get into the core of Ezra and Nehemiah.
Right, the whole intermarriage thing, staying true to their identity, God's people. Building walls in a temple is one thing, but rebuilding their spiritual core, that's next level.
You nailed it. And now, Ezra and Nehemiah, they step into the spotlight. Each of them, a leader, but in different ways. Guiding the people back to spiritual wholeness, back to God's law.
So, new chapter, new challenges, new leaders. Tell me about them. What were they like?
Ezra, remember, he was a priest, a scribe, the law of Moses. That was his jam. He comes to Jerusalem on fire, wanting to rekindle that passion in the people, to understand God's word, to live it out. He's the spiritual revivalist, calling them back to their roots, their covenant.
And Nehemiah, we know he rebuilt those walls. Man of action.
You got it. Gets things done. Organized, brave, inspires people to work together. He's focused on the practical stuff. Rebuilding the city, making it safe and secure. Two sides of the same coin.
Like, God knows what he's doing, right? Yeah. Different leaders, different strengths for different times. Ezra, the spiritual guy, and Nehemiah, the builder.
Yeah.
Working together to lead the people through this crucial time.
Exactly. God equips his people. And as we look closer at Ezra and Nehemiah, we see how they complement each other, meeting the spiritual needs, the practical needs, the whole package.
This deep dive has been quite a ride. A story that could seem boring, dusty, turns out to be packed with drama, lessons about leadership, faith, the struggles of rebuilding after, well, everything's broken.
It's been a joy unpacking all this with you.
And to you listening, thanks for being here. Hope you've been inspired, challenged by these stories of exile, return, and ultimately hope and rebuilding.
Remember, God is all about restoration. He wants to work in us, through us, to bring healing, hope, to make things whole again.
So until next time, keep seeking, keep exploring, keep diving deep.